Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, and I would like to welcome everyone to today's workshop, Updates from the 48th Annual San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, SABCS, on triple-negative breast cancer. And this program is supported by, is made possible by the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation. I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, before I introduce our first speaker, I would like to identify that there are on the call today over 215 participants, and you come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, and suburban communities. And we also have a number of international participants from Australia, Canada, Colombia, Denmark, Germany, Greece, Kenya, New Zealand, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom. So it's truly a global call. And it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Kate Lathrop. And Dr. Lathrop is Associate Professor, Division of Hematology and Oncology, UT Health San Antonio Breast Medical Oncology, Mays Cancer Center at UT Health San Antonio, Assistant Dean of Undergraduate Research, Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio Program Director, Medical Oncology and Hematology Fellowship Program, UT Health San Antonio Program Director, San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, SABCS. And Dr. Lathrop will be addressing clinical applications of circulating tumor DNA. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Lathrop.
Hi, thank you so much for that kind introduction, and I'm excited to share some of these abstracts and research projects that were presented at SABCS this year. Each year we have a little bit of a theme that emerges, and for triple negative breast cancer, a lot of the research that was presented is really focused on how we can better understand what Dr. Messner referred to as biomarkers to better design our clinical trials, but also maybe even more importantly, tailor treatment for our patients. So I wanted to go over two clinical trials that were presented at SABCS, but before I do, I think most of my time is really going to be about explaining the science behind this work, because it's quite complicated, but it's also very important, especially for people who are living with breast cancer or have been diagnosed with breast cancer, because this is going to be become a bigger part of our treatment discussions moving forward, especially in triple negative breast cancer. And that's looking at something called circulating tumor DNA and circulating tumor cells. And these are new technologies that allow doctors to look for tiny traces of breast cancer in the bloodstream without needing to do anything like CT scans or tissue biopsies. So all of our cells, including cancer cells, contain DNA, and that's the genetic instruction manual that make each cell unique in our body. And when cancer cells die or break apart, small fragments of their DNA can spill into the blood. And these fragments are called circulating tumor DNA. And some tests also can try to capture that whole cancer cell that might be floating in the bloodstream. Those are called circulating tumor cells. So this is often referred to as a liquid biopsy. So a tube of blood is drawn from the patient, and a very sensitive laboratory test is used to search that blood sample for a DNA sequence or whole cells that match the patient's specific breast cancer. So these modern laboratory machines can detect extremely small amounts, sometimes even just a few molecules of tumor DNA among millions of what we would consider normal fragments of DNA in the blood. And we can use this technology for a real-time, almost like progress report on what's going on for an individual patient that's being treated for breast cancer. So we can use this for patients who are receiving therapy, like chemotherapy or endocrine therapy, and we want to see what's happening to those levels over time. We can use this test potentially to see if an individual therapy is working well, because then we would expect the tumor DNA in the blood to drop down in the amount that's detectable or even potentially disappear. And if we see the ctDNA starting to rise, that also could be an indication that maybe the therapy is not working as well as it used to be, or the cancer is becoming resistant. So by using this as a monitoring, even before surgery or after surgery, it helps us know whether maybe patients need more therapy or less therapy. So it's going to be quite an important thing that's going to be moving out of clinical trials maybe in the next 2-3 years and into what we're doing routinely in the clinic. So the first clinical trial that was reported that I want to talk about was the evaluation of whole exome sequencing of a tumor. So that's where you go in and you look at a lot of the data in the tumor to inform how we do that test. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that now. So we talked about what ctDNA is in general terms. Now we're going to go even a little further, and we're going to talk about what tumor-informed ctDNA assays mean. So this is almost like the next step. So this is a customized way of looking in a specific patient for circulating tumor DNA from their actual tumor. So the way that this is done is that we analyze the actual tumor sample. So we do have to have a biopsy for this. And we look for specific cancer genes, and we call those variants. So variants are small changes or mutations in the DNA that make the cancer cells genetically different from your normal cells. So you can almost think of it like there's a spelling mistake in the cancer's instruction manual. We're trying to find those little tiny mistakes. So you take the patient's tumor, we sequence it, we compare it to what we consider normal cells in the body. That can be like a normal white blood cell that's also in the blood sample. And then we go look for those personalized variants in a patient's bloodstream. And what this did was we looked at a clinical trial that was already done. It was called the NSABP B59 study. And that study was looking at whether adding an immunotherapy, which his name is atezolizumab, to standard chemotherapy was better or not. So that was what the clinical trial was trying to answer. But what we're focused on is they also did a study where they took the patient's tumor and did this informed circulating tumor DNA assay on those patients. So they followed the patients over time for about 24 months. So they had blood draws before any treatment started. Then they had blood draws after the chemotherapy and the immunotherapy were given, and then they had blood draws after surgery, and then they continued to do those for at 1 year and 2 years post-treatment. And they found some very exciting things. One, this assay or this test for circulating tumor DNA seemed to work very well. So at the beginning, so before any treatment, 96% of patients, we were able to find the circulating tumor DNA. So these are patients with either stage 2 or stage 3 triple negative breast cancer, which is the group that we would generally give chemotherapy and other medications to before surgery, which is called neoadjuvant therapy. So 96% of those patients, we were able to find circulating tumor cell DNA in the bloodstream. After the treatment, but before surgery, so after the chemotherapy and before surgery, that 96% dropped to only 9%. And then after surgery, it went from 9% to 6%. So we were able to see a dramatic drop in the circulating tumor cell DNA. What they then did was they compared the circulating tumor cell DNA, whether it was positive or negative, to whether the patient had what's called a pathologic complete response, which is when the pathologist or the doctor that looks at the tumor under the microscope is not able to see any viable or alive tumor after the chemotherapy and they've removed part of the breast or the whole breast. That's called a pathologic complete response if there's no viable tumor left, and it's called a non-pathologic complete response if we still see viable tumor. So for patients who still had viable tumor, 21% of them also still had circulating tumor cell DNA, whereas if all the tumor in the breast and the lymph nodes had resolved, only 2% of those patients had circulating tumor cell DNA. And then they asked, well, what happened if you still had circulating tumor cell DNA after the treatment with chemotherapy? And some of these patients also received immunotherapy. And what they found was there was a much, much higher risk of recurrence in patients that still had circulating tumor cell DNA after they received their treatment. It was about 78% of patients that still had positive circulating tumor cell DNA went on to have a recurrence. So what's so important about this is it may be able to sort patients into a group of patients who we need to do more therapy for to help prevent recurrence of the breast cancer, and also, just importantly, help us know which patients do not need to have additional therapy after surgery. So the second abstract that I want to talk about was also based on a clinical trial that was already done called C-TRAC. What's different about this project is that they were trying to take that circulating tumor cell DNA and make it a little bit easier to do. So instead of getting a patient's biopsy and sequencing the tumor and then finding those variants we talked about, this test was just looking to see if we can use an assay that just looks for kind of generic mistakes that might happen in a cancer cell, particularly in a breast cancer cell. And can we use just a generic test instead of making it based on an individualized person's tumor? Because if we can use a generic test, then we might have a much better ability to use that test in a larger group of patients with less time and potentially less cost. And so what they found is when they used this generic circulating tumor cell DNA assay, they were also able to get very accurate predictions of which patients were going to have a potential recurrence if they still had circulating tumor cell DNA by that assay after they were done with their initial treatment. Their risk of recurrence was much higher. So in this clinical trial, for patients that had no detected circulating tumor cell DNA using the generic test, the vast majority of those patients also did not experience a recurrence, whereas those that we did detect the circulating tumor cell DNA, they did have a high risk of recurrence in the future. So these two abstracts are really important, and they show how we can potentially use this new technology to identify patients who are going to be at higher risk of relapse, and also how we can maybe potentially monitor patients moving forward. And I'm going to pause there.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Lathrop. Just a stellar presentation. And as the first speaker, you really set the tone for today's program. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Roberto Leonfier. And Dr. Leonfier is Associate Professor of Oncology, Department of Oncology, co-chair of the Mayo Clinic TNBC Working Group, Associate Program Director, Advanced Breast Medical Oncology Fellowship Program, Mayo Clinic. And Dr. Leon Ferrer will be addressing predicting response to neoadjuvant chemotherapy in triple negative breast cancer. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Leon Ferrer.
Well, thank you, Caroline, and it's a great pleasure to join you in this call today. And following on the heels of Dr. Lathrop, my two studies that I'll discuss next are moving now from looking at markers in the blood to looking at markers in the tissue, in the tumor tissue, to try to, again, see if we can better understand which patients are going to have a better response to the treatments and perhaps may need less treatment moving forward, or the counter side of that, of course, is patients that perhaps are not going to respond too well to our planned treatment and may benefit from additional treatments after that identification. So the first study focuses on analyzing tissue, tumor tissue, before any treatment started, and it's actually an analysis of this one of the same clinical trials that Dr. Lathrop mentioned at the beginning. So in the same study that Dr. Lathrop discussed initially, they also did analysis looking at the tissue before the patients started any chemotherapy. And they focused on two specific markers or two specific analyses. The first one is what's called TILs, or tumor infiltrating lymphocytes present in the tumor. And these are essentially immune cells from the person that has the breast cancer tumor that manage to invade the tumor tissue and presumably are trying to fight it and trying to get rid of the cancer cells. There have been multiple studies before that have shown that the higher the number of these lymphocytes that are present in the tumor in TNBC, the better patients do overall. For example, when the levels of TILs are very high and patients receive chemotherapy before surgery, they're more likely to achieve what's called a pathologic complete response or complete eradication of the cancer by the time of surgery. And in addition, there have been studies that have shown that patients with higher TILs in their tumors have lower risk of recurrences and a higher likelihood of being cured. And even in patients with very early stage breast cancer, so stage one, there is some suggestion that maybe these markers can identify patients that perhaps do not need as much chemotherapy or chemotherapy altogether if they have very high levels of these markers. So in this particular study, they looked at this immune infiltrating cells to see if we could identify who benefited from the addition of immunotherapy. As many of you may be aware, currently we use immunotherapy for patients with stage 2 and 3 triple negative breast cancer, but we don't yet have a great marker to see who actually needs immunotherapy and who perhaps does not need it or does not benefit from it. So what they found is that patients with higher TILs overall had lower rates of recurrence and lower risk of dying from breast cancer when they received immunotherapy. And it seemed in this preliminary analysis that those that had lower levels of immune cells did not benefit as much from the immunotherapy. Again, now this is still, science that is ongoing, and it's by no means definitive, but it does suggest that maybe we can look into this immune cell subsets to try to identify patients who truly derive that benefit from immunotherapy and spare those that may not need it. It was also interesting that even though patients that had lower TILs did not seem to have a lower risk of recurrence, it seemed like those patients that had lower TILs did have a higher rate of pathologic complete response with the immunotherapy addition, even though their initial TILs were low. So again, two factors that are slightly contradictory here, but that potentially shed some light for additional studies in the future. And then they looked at a second way of trying to determine whether these tumors have some immune responses going on within them. They looked at what's called molecular subtypes of triple negative. There have been some methods that have been developed to try to classify triple-negative breast cancer in subtypes. You know, we all know that triple-negative breast cancer is not a single disease, but actually there are multiple subtypes that perhaps have different responses to different treatments. So they looked at a particular test that allows to classify the triple-negative breast cancer tumors in four molecular subtypes. Two of those are, you know, tumors that have some immune responses. One is called BLIA, which stands for basal-like immune activated, so suggesting these are the tumors that have the most robust immune responses. And then there's another subtype called immune suppressed, which may still have immune cells visible in the tumor, but perhaps these cells are not functioning as well. And there are two other subtypes called mesenchymal and luminal androgen receptor, but those, I'm not going to focus too much on those in this call because those were a small subset of triple negative breast cancer. The vast majority were the other two subtypes, the immune activated and the immune suppressed. And what they found is that as we would imagine, as we would predict, the benefit of immunotherapy was seen primarily in those tumors that had that immune activated subtype. Again, suggesting that we may be able to gain additional insights on how to treat triple negative breast cancer by using these two parameters, you know, not just the number of immune cells, but also looking at the subtype of triple negative breast cancer based on immune responses. So that was the main, I would say, the main findings of the first study. The second study, on the other hand, looked at tissue not at the beginning of the patient's journey, but actually at the end of chemotherapy. So once patients completed their chemotherapy and they underwent surgery, they took that tissue that was present at the time of surgery and looked at two markers to try again to predict whether we could find certain features that tell us who is more likely to experience a recurrence and perhaps who has a lower risk for that. So they took samples from nine clinical trials, including over 600 patients who had received chemotherapy before surgery and had not achieved a pathologic complete response, meaning the patients that had some residual cancer that was still viable after chemotherapy, which often are the patients that we worry the most about in clinic. You know, those are the patients that we worry that if the chemo was not able to completely eradicate the tumor cells by the time the chemo had ended, we worry that they perhaps have a higher risk of having a recurrence. And we often recommend additional chemotherapy or additional treatments after surgery has been completed. But we do recognize that there are often patients that, despite having some residual disease and some residual tumors after chemotherapy, still never have a recurrence. So this is what this study is trying to look at. Can we look at other markers, right? And they looked at two parameters. One was the same tumor-infiltrating lymphocyte that I discussed in the previous study. And the second marker was a marker called Ki-67, which is a marker of tumor cell proliferation. Basically tells us more or less the proportion of cancer cells that are actively replicating, growing, trying to cause trouble. And what they found is that if the tumor had a high level of proliferation or high level of Ki-67 at the end of chemotherapy, that that was associated with a higher risk of recurrence and a higher risk of death from breast cancer. But on the other hand, as similar to the other study, those patients that had a significant number of immune cells in the residual tumor, on the other hand, had the lower risk of recurrence and mortality. And the most useful information was perhaps when both of those markers were used together. And basically, the takeaway is that despite not achieving a complete response, so despite having some residual disease, those patients whose residual tumors had both high levels of immune cells and low levels of proliferation in the residual tumor, those patients had the best prognosis with the lowest risk of recurrence and the highest survival rates, perhaps even comparable to the patients that achieve a complete response. So again, I think this study confirms what we have suspected for, a long time that not all residual disease after neoadjuvant chemotherapy has the same risk or is not created equal, and that even if the tumor does not fully respond to chemo, there are some patients who still have a good prognosis and perhaps may not need some of the treatments that we currently recommend based on the fear of the risk for recurrence. So I think moving forward, you know, the more interesting thing will be to see how can we make sense of all of these markers, all of this data. Can we combine, you know, these markers in the tissue with the markers for circulating tumor DNA that Dr. Lathrop mentioned, and perhaps many other features to try to come up with certain models that help us really tell in a summary what that means for the treatment of a patient moving forward. And with that, I will hand it over back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Lampierre. That was, a stellar presentation. Lots of information. I know there'll be lots of questions for you for the Q&A as well. So thank you so much. And yeah, you'll definitely have lots of questions in the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Julie Fisher, and Dr. Fisher is medical oncologist, Levine Cancer Institute co-director, Sandra Levine Young Women's Breast Cancer Program, Associate Hematologist Oncology Fellowship Director, Levine Cancer Institute. And Dr. Fish will be addressing novel therapeutics and therapy-related toxicity in triple-negative breast cancer. It's now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Fisher.
Great. Thank you all so much for having me. Very excited to talk about some of the newer frontiers. We're in an era of cancer treatment, and particularly in the triple negative space, we're always trying to treat cancer effectively. And as treatments become more and more sophisticated, we're working to make those treatments less toxic. And so some of these studies are looking at potentially less toxic treatments that we hope, of course, will be equally effective. And one of these is the Phase 3 ASCENT 3 trial. And this is a trial, that describes, you know, patient-reported outcomes with sacituzumab govitecan versus traditional chemotherapy. So basically, it's looking at triple-negative breast cancer patients who are not eligible for immunotherapy, either because they have PD-L1 negative disease or they're not candidates for other reasons. They took those patients and either gave them standard chemotherapy or sacituzumab govitecan, which is a conjugate agent that kind of links an antibody therapy with chemo. And basically, what they found was that the responses were comparable, but the toxicity with the sacituzumab was significantly improved compared to chemotherapy. So patients who received the sacituzumab self-reported improved physical functioning, delay to physical deterioration. They had less decline, fewer side effects. They reported better health, appetite, just general well-being overall compared to the groups getting chemotherapy. So overall well-being was better and was better preserved with the sacituzumab cohort compared to the chemotherapy cohort. In addition, the drug sacituzumab showed superior progression-free survival and more durable responses. So this is important for a couple of reasons. Certainly, it establishes this drug as a new potential standard of care in terms of the front line. We're typically using this drug in many other arenas for the triple-negative population. But in addition, you know, it's again, when we've got something that works as well or even better, but with demonstrated less toxicity, clearly that's a step in the right direction in a lot of ways. I always tell my patients, our goal is to treat your cancer as well as effectively as possible while maintaining your quality of life as well as possible. We've made a lot of strides in terms of efficacious treatments, and I'm thrilled to find that we're now able to fine-tune and work just as hard on improving quality of life with these treatments as well. Let's see here. Moving forward to another study. Let's take a peek here. So another group looked, so again, on those lines, we know that chemotherapy can be effective. We know that chemotherapy can be toxic. And these days, we've got lots of other drugs in the arsenal that are not true cytotoxic, aka cell-killing chemotherapy drugs. So TBCRC 56 phase 2 study was looking at a preoperative chemotherapy-free regimen for patients with early-stage triple-negative breast cancer who harbored germline BRCA or PALB2 mutations. So we know that genetic mutations account for a pretty small number of breast cancers. But patients that do harbor those inherited genetic mutations can be candidates for different types of treatment. Triple-negative breast cancer, quite frequently, increasingly in the last 10 years, is treated with neoadjuvant or preoperative chemotherapy. And in fact, a lot of that chemotherapy has been kind of upgraded to include a more aggressive baseline regimen and with the addition of immunotherapy. So this is actually looking at really changing that approach altogether, again, specifically for the patient with the BRCA or PALB mutation. And instead of giving them neoadjuvant chemotherapy / immunotherapy, they're actually using a chemotherapy-free regimen that uses a PARP inhibitor with an immunotherapeutic agent. And interestingly, this was found to be highly effective for patients who harbor those mutations, who have triple negative breast cancers. The pathologic complete response rates were equivalent. And definitely these agents, PARP inhibitors, immunotherapy, they certainly do have their own side effect profiles, but overall they're significantly less toxic than these chemotherapy regimens. So again, this non-chemotherapeutic regimen is demonstrating equal efficacy compared to the chemo arm. So again, we're getting a great response at less toxicity cost to the patient, a win all around. One last study that touches on kind of quality of life issues, again, with our triple negative cohort specifically, a group out of the University of Kansas wanted to look at what is the impact of immunotherapy, checkpoint inhibitor therapy, on fertility in patients who are getting neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Again, patients with non-metastatic triple-negative breast cancer increasingly receive neoadjuvant or pre-op chemotherapy as part of their treatment. Increasingly, the standard of care has become chemotherapy that includes immunotherapy. We've known for decades that cytotoxic chemotherapy affects fertility. And so the question is, well, what does checkpoint inhibition, what does immunotherapy do on top of that? Is there an additive effect? And for better or for worse, this study does indeed show patients who received immunotherapy in addition to chemotherapy absolutely did have higher rates of chemotherapy-induced ovarian failure, and fewer of those patients experienced ovarian function recovery. So again, lets us know that immunotherapy, which is an important part of what is now, the standard preoperative treatment for these patients, immunotherapy negatively affects fertility even more than chemotherapy alone. Again, just something for us to be aware of at this point. It's important for us to keep in mind as we're counseling patients, pre-treatment fertility counseling and potential fertility preservation become even more important. And then again, our desire to downgrade toxicity without downgrading effectiveness becomes even more and more important as we go forward. Those are some of the main kind of quality of life, you know, studies or studies that touched on quality of life in our triple negative breast cancer patients. In addition, I was also asked to talk a little bit about helping patients prepare for telehealth and telemedicine appointments. Wouldn't say there are guidelines per se, but certainly when we kind of distill a lot of the education that comes out of this conference, we can provide some basic guidelines for people to keep in mind as they're entering those appointments. It's important to make sure you have working technology. So just as the speaker team did today before embarking on this talk, we all tested our devices to make sure everything was working, test an internet connection. If your healthcare center has a patient portal or a specific app that needs to be downloaded, it's important to, you know, to make sure you have access to that. And something that I find challenging when I'm doing this in my own personal life is finding a quiet, private space. To the extent possible, obviously, that's something that's going to be helpful. As far as preparing for the medical component of the visit, always a good idea to kind of write out what are your top priorities for this visit. It's good to list kind of new or worsening symptoms, any kind of side effects. If there are any outside records or labs or imaging that have been performed outside of the system that your telehealth provider is functioning in, good to have those handy. And if there's any changes that you've noticed at home, changes in weight, changes in temperature, changes in blood glucose levels, anything that you're monitoring at home, it's good to have kind of a record of those. And it's just, you know, again, hopefully you have the kind of relationship with your provider that you feel comfortable with this. But I always encourage people, we want you to be really crystal clear about quality of life issues. I want you to be really crystal clear if anything I've said is unclear and requires clarification. It's a good idea to kind of ask the doctor, okay, well, what would cause me to call you? What would cause me to go to the emergency room? If you prefer telehealth visits, it's important to kind of clarify with your provider. You know, is it okay to always do telehealth visits? How frequently should we have one-on-one in-person visits? I think those are all good kind of cues. And then after the visit, always a good idea to review the either after-visit summary or the note. Most patient portals will allow you access to the actual copy of the office visit note once it's been completed. And so always nice to review. We are certainly not perfect, and sometimes things get mistranscribed or misheard. So always important to make sure, you know, that everything looks like you expected. I always advise people between telehealth visits and regular visits, keep kind of a running list of issues or questions. Many of us may have a brilliant question that comes to mind at 3 a.m. 2 weeks after your visit. Always good to kind of keep those things written down and ready to go for your next encounter. So hopefully that's helpful. Obviously happy to answer any questions about any of these things. And I will pass the baton on to the next speaker.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Fisher. That was just a stellar presentation. And I know there'll be lots of questions for you for the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Arlene Brothers. And Arlene Brothers is Interim Executive Director, Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation. And she'll be describing the free national programs and services of the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation, a wonderful resource for all of you on the call today. And she'll also describe the TNBCF line, the phone number, and website as well. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Brothers.
Thank you, Dr. Mesner. And thank you, doctors, for your very informative presentations. Those are really, really helpful for our community. We're extremely proud to partner with Cancer Care on this and other workshops where the focus is specifically on triple negative breast cancer. You can find podcast recordings of previous workshops on the Cancer Care website by searching Triple Negative Breast Cancer or by visiting tnbcwebinars.org. And since we're talking about SABCS, I would like to highlight our annual program, Your Guide to SABCS, which includes daily blog updates as well as video interviews with doctors and researchers and other breast cancer advocates. Most of these interviews were conducted on site at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, and we'll be adding a few more as we catch up with some other doctors in the coming weeks. We find that by combining expert coverage with patient-friendly commentary, we're able to remove the barriers of technical language and in-person attendance, allowing a broader audience to access breakthroughs, trial updates, and practical implications for patients and caregivers. The website for that program is yourguidetosabcs.org. So please visit the website and check out all the wonderful content we have there direct from SABCS. For more TNBC-specific programs and resources, visit tnbcfoundation.org or follow us on social media for regular updates and announcements, such as our upcoming TNBC Awareness Month that kicks off on TNBC Day, which is March 3rd. So thank you all for joining us today, and I'll turn the program back to Dr. Mesner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Struthers, and this is just a wonderful go-to organization for everybody on the call today. Can't think of a better organization to go to get information about triple-negative breast cancer, so thank you so much. And also, we will be sending a SurveyMonkey evaluation to all of you about the program, but in that evaluation, we will include any phone numbers, websites, anything that we've offered, so you'll be able to have it with you. So although you've been trying to write this all down, we'll send it to you in the SurveyMonkey evaluation. And our next speaker is Jennifer LaPietra, and she's an oncology social worker. She's our patient assistance program manager, cancer care. And Ms. LaPietra will be discussing Cancer Care's free national programs and services and our Hope Line and website as well. I will turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. LaPietra.
Thank you, Dr. Mesner. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jennifer LaPietra, and I'm here to discuss our cancer care programs and services and hope to meet some of your needs. My role here includes working with women diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer and their families. The Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation and Cancer Care have partnered together to ensure that those diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer have access to free psychosocial services and support. There are many aspects of a breast cancer diagnosis that could be addressed through psychosocial supportive services, including making informed treatment decisions, quality of life concerns, navigating clinical trials, learning about your fertility options, and communication with one's medical team. The Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation has also generously funded the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Helpline, which provides callers with access to comprehensive services. Some comprehensive services the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation and Cancer Care provide include resource navigation, counseling, educational workshops, publications, and limited financial assistance. By calling the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Helpline, individuals are connected to an oncology social worker who is aware of the physical, emotional, and practical challenges that may arise when diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer. A cancer diagnosis can also be overwhelming. Establishing a network for additional support and guidance may help relieve feelings of anxiety and increase feelings of hope and empowerment. Joining a support group can offer the chance for triple negative breast cancer patients to speak with one another, gather information, and provide support. Cancer Care offers triple negative breast cancer specific national online support groups for patients and caregivers, respectively, which are moderated by oncology social workers. As experiences with triple negative breast cancer vastly differ from other populations, such a support group provides members with the opportunity to speak about their unique and specific challenges in a safe space with people who will understand. You can register for an online support group through cancercare.org by selecting Our Services, then Support Groups. Individuals may also experience practical and financial concerns throughout one's treatment. please know that if you are encountering such financial hardships, there are organizations that may be able to help. Cancer Care's Resource Navigation offers a short-term, strengths-based approach to patients and caregivers affected by cancer nationally. A trained specialist will work with the client in connecting them to resources, referrals, and financial assistance. If you're interested in learning more about the services the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation and Cancer Care offer, I encourage you to call the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Helpline at 877-880-8622. Our oncology social workers can share additional information about our services and can also help you explore ways to connect with others, including our support groups and financial assistance resources. It has been a pleasure to be a part of this workshop. I thank my colleagues for inviting me here today, and thank you for your attention. I will now turn the workshop back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. LaPietra. That was a superb presentation, stellar in every way, and just a wonderful resource as well for all of our participants on the call today. And now we're going to move right on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Regina to explain to you how to queue up for questions. Regina?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And so I have a question for Dr. Lathrop. Should cDNA testing be done to monitor a patient for recurrence or metastases? If so, do you use Guardian 300 Signatura?
Yeah, so those are, so the Guardian 360 assay is usually looking for specific mutations that things like an ESR1 mutation or something called a PI3 kinase mutation or a BRCA mutation, that we have specific therapeutics that we can match to that mutation. So those are assays we use routinely in the metastatic setting, so people who've had a recurrence of their breast cancer. As far as doing things like circulating tumor cell DNA, which was the Prosigna assay that was mentioned, I do those on clinical trials, but off of clinical trials, I am not doing them because we don't really have sufficient evidence to know, you know, how specifically to use those in clinic. And in general, I don't like to do tests if I'm not going to, you know, have an actionable item in mind on what I'm going to do when I get that test back. So I highly encourage people to use these assays on clinical trials currently.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Leon, for a question for you, do oncologists still use Adriamycin in neoadjuvant chemo, or have they switched to carboplatin?
Thank you. Yeah, that's an excellent question. So for triple negative breast cancer specifically, for most patients that receive neoadjuvant chemotherapy and have stage 2 or 3 disease, the current recommendation includes an anthracycline still. So we use a combination of chemotherapy and immunotherapy, and the clinical trial that established immunotherapy included an anthracycline. For patients with stage 1 triple negative breast cancer, there's a lot of controversies. There's a, you know, potentially a subset of those patients that may not need an anthracycline, and you know, particularly if they have smaller tumors or lymph node negative, you know, many of us are comfortable in specific selected patients to omit the anthracycline. But I think as we get newer treatments, particularly now that we incorporate immunotherapy, this is a question that is in all of our minds, just like it has happened for HER2-positive breast cancer or ER-positive breast cancer. You know, as we get more directed, targeted therapies, perhaps we can let go of the anthracycline, and this is still being tested in several clinical trials, but there's one specifically that is purposely testing the omission of the anthracycline and replacing this with only the carboplatin, taxane, and immunotherapy. We will hopefully have results of that study in the next coming years and be able to definitively answer that question.
Thank you so much. And for Dr. Fisher, which treatments for triples penetrate the blood-brain barrier?
Oh, interesting question. Frankly, most of the standard like neoadjuvant therapies do not. There are a few agents out there that penetrate the blood-brain barrier. Capecitabine is one of them. We will sometimes use that in the adjuvant setting. But for the most part, the standard agents that we're using do not penetrate the blood-brain barrier. That is why, historically, when someone does manifest CNS metastasis, radiation becomes kind of the cornerstone of treatment because there's a paucity of agents that we use in that setting that cross the blood-brain barrier. There are agents that do, but again, kind of the standard package that he just referenced for neoadjuvant triple-negative disease, most of those agents do not.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And for Dr. Lathrop, should PD-L1 be standard lab at diagnosis of a triple? So Keytruda can be given to those who have PD-L1. Would you give it to those who are PD-L1 negative? Why risk the potential side effects?
Yeah, so great question. In patients with metastatic or advanced disease, actually testing for PD-L1 expression in the tumor of at least 10% seems to predict positive results from the treatment. But in our patients with early stage disease, we have not found that testing for PD-L1 expression actually influences the result of treating with immunotherapy. So right now for women with triple negative breast cancer at a certain stage, generally if it's about a 2 centimeter or greater tumor size or if the lymph nodes are involved, we do recommend the addition of immunotherapy to those patients regardless of their PD-L1 expression.
Thank you. And question for Dr. Leon Furrer. When Trodelvy becomes intolerable with side effects, which is the next treatment to try when Trodelvy is the first-line treatment once diagnosed metastatic?
Thank you. Yeah, excellent question as well, and one for which, we don't have a great answer yet. You know, with Trodelvy or sacituzumab govitecan being a relatively new drug, one of the challenges is what are the drugs that have activity after, Trodelvy. Now, when the drug is discontinued because of side effects, I think it's a little different than when the drug is discontinued because it stopped working. So I think, we would go back to several of the drugs that we used before we had Trodelvy. You know, traditional chemotherapy drugs would certainly be reasonable, particularly those that have different side effects, a different side effect profile than Trodelvy. We do have a subset of patients that could be eligible for trastuzumab deruxtecan as well, or Enhertu. I think that certainly is very reasonable, particularly in patients that are stopping sacituzumab for side effects, not for disease resistance or progression. But I think this is a very active space and, a lot to be learned, and there's a lot of clinical trials currently testing newer drugs in the hopes of, being able to overcome the resistance that tumors develop after Trodelvy. So I anticipate we'll see more of that in the subsequent meetings.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Lathrop, what is the name of the first study you mentioned?
Oh, that was the NSABP B59 was the name of that clinical trial.
Thank you.
It stands for National Surgical Adjuvant Breast, so NSABP-59.
So, and then this would be a question for Dr. Fisher. What are the most effective treatment options today when Trodelvy becomes intolerable due to severe side effects, and in what order of effectiveness?
I think we kind of, that sounds very similar to the prior question, but again, sometimes it becomes a little bit of dealer's choice. We had all hoped, I think, when next generation sequencing came out that it would offer us kind of a roadmap. Okay, this is your next option, and this is your next best option. As it stands, you know, when you're eligible for multiple drugs, we still don't quite know, you know, exactly which is going to be best. It's very tumor specific. So there's still a good bit of kind of, like I said, dealer's choice and trial and error. For somebody, and again, I also agree, if the treatment has been stopped due to excess toxicity, sometimes that kind of guides us as well. What was the toxicity? Was it, you know, was it something subjective like severe nausea and vomiting? Was it LFT, liver function testing abnormalities? So sometimes if it's something specific, we can be guided by, you know, looking for an agent that's going to specifically minimize that particular side effect. Otherwise, you know, certainly if a patient has just started with Trodelvy, you know, we look for a drug with a different mechanism of action. You know, if they've never had, if they're chemotherapy naive, you know, certainly we can think about a taxane. We can think about capecitabine. There's a number of different, you know, kind of possibilities out there. This is the previously triple negative category has been complicated a little bit by the somewhat newer HER2 low and HER2 ultra low category. So if someone has previously been billed as triple negative but actually has minimal expression of overexpression of the HER2 new protein, that opens up that class of drugs as well. But by and large, there isn't a specific this is number one, this is number two, this is number three. It becomes patient dependent. And as I said, if the Trodelvy was stopped based on toxicity, the specific type of toxicity would potentially guide our hands.
Thank you. And now I'm going to ask our speakers to just provide a takeaway, each of them, and I'll start with Dr. Lathrop.
Yeah, thanks, and thanks for the invitation to talk. I think my takeaway is that in the next, hopefully, few years, we're going to really see ctDNA evolve into something that we're using routinely in our clinic to help monitor patients for recurrence before they have symptoms, but also maybe potentially to help either escalate or de-escalate treatment so that we can better fit the treatment to individualized patients.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Leon Fierro-Ferrer?
Yes, I fully agree with that statement that ctDNA will become, probably more standardly integrated into our decision-making. Mm-hmm. My takeaway from the data that I presented is that despite the advances in ctDNA and those technologies, we will not forget about tissue, and I think that it'll still important for us to interrogate the tumor tissue as much as we can to identify markers that allow us to tailor treatment. And I will just say, you know, as you heard today, a lot of the data that we discussed today came from clinical trials, and I think this highlights the importance of clinical trials, not just to test the particular treatment that the trial is testing, but also because it allows us to gain so many insights. You know, just today you heard about two completely different studies done in the same clinical trial using the same clinical samples. So just keep that in mind as you get approached for clinical trials too.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Dr. Fisher?
Yeah, I would say, we know that chemotherapy, particularly the regimens that we're typically reaching for patients with triple negative breast cancer, we know that chemotherapy is really, really hard. And clearly our primary goal is treating cancer as effectively as possible and reducing the long-term risk of recurrence as much as possible. And we recognize that the tools that we've had at our disposal historically are rough and hard on people, and we are working on identifying regimens that are equally effective while being a little more manageable and tolerable for patients. So I want everybody to know we see you, we see the difficulty, we prioritize both things. We prioritize effective treatment, and we're working on making those effective treatments as tolerable as possible.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. And Ms. Salding Brothers?
Hi. If there are folks participating today who have never heard of the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation, please come and find us at tnbcfoundation.org. And for specific SABCS content, visit yourguidetosabcs.org. Thank you all.
Thank you so much. And Ms. Jennifer LaPietra?
Oh, thank you so much. I just wanted to reiterate that all of your questions are valid and deserve a good response from your medical team. And to just know that your cancer experience is unique to you. You're all writing your own stories, and there is good support available for all of you. So keep us in mind when things come up.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've just been phenomenal. I also want to thank our participants for asking such great questions. Although we couldn't take all of your questions, we took many of your questions, and I would like to comment on them. If you didn't get to ask your question, please ask your healthcare team your question. And if you did have a chance to ask a question, again, go back to your healthcare team member. They know you the best. They have all of your records, and of course, they will be very helpful to you. Also, remember that you are not alone. You have the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation as a go-to organization, and we'll be sending you all the information about them so that you'll be able to access their resources as well as Cancer Cares. Also, we have noticed that many of you have no difficulty reaching your healthcare team during the day, but evenings, weekends, and holidays tend to be challenging. So always ask your healthcare team how you can contact them evenings, weekends, and holidays. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.